Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good morning, everybody here from Chicago, Illinois. Welcome to today's podcast. In today's segment, we have the honor and privilege of talking with Mr. Sean Nobles. He is the founder and president of a leading cybersecurity firm known as NavSec, and they're based in Tampa, Florida. Sean, thanks for your time, and let's go and get started, please.
Thanks, Robbie.
Yeah, so we looked up your bio. We did some snooping on you. We didn't do a background check or anything like that. But you seem to have a very deep and rich background in cybersecurity. Can you tell us how you got started in cyber and maybe some of the achievements you've done in cybersecurity? And tell us about your experience, I believe, in the Marine Corps, too. You were telling me this before the show.
Yeah, absolutely. So started out in cybersecurity kind of even before I had a career, just messing with computer systems, mainly my own, and learning in labs and learning about how software copywriting worked and things like that. And it went from just a curiosity to, as I started my career, I went into the dial-up ISPs and worked at those, and always had kind of a thread of security when I was approaching any job that I had. And I did the dial-up ISP stuff for a couple of years and me into the Marine Corps. I was doing the math. Wow. I was actually 20 years ago today, I was in boot camp at Parris Island. So it's quite a few years ago. But when I was in the Marine Corps, I did data networking and what they call technical control or TechCon. And even back in those early days of 2000, the Marine Corps started taking cybersecurity seriously. And I remember we had firewalls that we used to deploy whenever we'd go to the field or we'd go out on an exercise. After the Marine Corps, I was a network engineer for the Navy, and I kind of jumped around a bunch of different technical disciplines and just always had an eye on cybersecurity.
Cool. Do you serve on any aircraft carriers or any submarines or anything like that? Or?
I was on ship for maybe 3 weeks. We did what's called a fleet week, where it's just basically a fun time to get on a ship and go up to, in my case, New York City. I was up there for three weeks basically doing PR stuff and walking around downtown and helping out and things like that. After I got out and I was a network engineer for the Navy, I worked in Pearl Harbor at the shipyard there. So I spent some time, I went on a submarine like once just to install a piece of network equipment. But other than that, that's pretty light shipboard service when I was in.
Well, thanks for your service there, Sean. Thank you so much for that. Now, to your company.
I appreciate it.
One more thing I want to ask you. I've seen, this is totally off the cuff, I've seen videos where you're in boot camp and your instructors are literally yelling at you. Is that really true?
Yeah, it's absolutely, and probably when the camera's off, it gets worse. But they definitely yell at you.
I don't know how you can understand anything they say. I couldn't understand anything they're saying. This, but anyway, that's a totally different topic for a different day. But anyway, so how did you venture into NavSec? Is this a company that you created on your own, or how did it transpire?
Yeah, so that's kind of an interesting path, too. I guess it started back, I decided to get out of the Marine Corps. I spent all of 2005 overseas in Ramadi and Fallujah and Al-Qaim, and I almost stayed in, and I got orders to re-enlist and be a Marine security guard, to work in embassies, be an embassy guard, and had a kind of rough week in September 2005, a couple weeks before I had to sign on the dotted line, and decided at that point, okay, maybe I can get out. And even then I was thinking, okay, I'll get out and eventually I want to start a business. So it was always kind of something I wanted to do, to start a business. And after a couple of attempts that didn't really pan out, I started my first business in 2008. It was a satellite communications and network engineering, basically services company, where my customers were General Dynamics and companies like that doing SATCOM type work. And after that, I started that company, I think I was 25 or 26 or 27, somewhere around in there, and ran that for 5 or 6 years, and it kept the lights on. But I thought to myself, well, maybe I'll go back to work at a normal company. And I'm still pretty young, and I thought maybe there are some leaders that I could learn from and get some mentoring in leadership and business. So I ended up back 2010, 2011-ish. We wound down all the contracts that we had, and I went to work. First company I worked at after that was a financial services company in Colorado, and I was an infrastructure manager there. And then I moved to a call center company. Then I worked for a wireless equipment reseller and just kind of jumped around and didn't really find the mentorship I was looking for. And I figured if I was going to work myself to death, then I'd work myself to death in my own company. So it's kind of back in 2015, that's when Sequoia Cyber Solutions started, which is kind of the precursor to Navisec. In 2019, we rebranded and changed our imagery and our company name and things like that. And so now we're Navisec, and we focused 100% on cybersecurity at that point, where before that we had cloud services and a couple other things that we did. But we've been solely a cybersecurity company doing offensive cybersecurity and defensive cybersecurity since the beginning of 2019.
How did you get the name Navisec? Or Navisec, actually.
Yeah, that's an interesting story, too. It was actually, we were talking a little bit before the show, a good friend of mine works for the business incubator at Purdue University there, and he's an MFA in, I don't know, he does marketing and stuff now, and I've worked with him for quite a while, and we sat down and, you know, did kind of a marketing discovery type sit down. And one of the things that we had noticed even before that was when we would call different parts of the U.S. and, you know, sometimes we'd have to explain what a Sequoia was. And we wanted to go with something a little more universal and also capture just kind of the, I don't know, we came up with this idea that there's rough waters of cybersecurity and we're going to help you navigate those rough waters. And there's a lot of misinformation and a lot of vendors out there. I don't know if it's as bad as it used to be, but it used to be, you know, this is the only cybersecurity solution you'll ever need. And that was just dangerous thinking. So our idea was we would navigate, and that's kind of where Navisec came from, help you navigate security.
No, excellent. Cool. Now, how long have you guys been in business?
We started as Sequoia Cyber Solutions back in 2015. And like I said before, we always had a focus on cybersecurity, even when we were Sequoia Cyber Solutions. But we also did other things like wireless network optimization and design, and we hosted servers for a couple of clients of ours. And we decided in 2019, when we changed the name, that we were only going to focus on cybersecurity services. So at that point is when we kind of shifted from just an IT, we'll do anything company, to only cybersecurity.
Okay. Now, how long have you been in business? Oh, you just did. Okay. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask to clarify, but I think you hit on it.
Okay. Now, do you have a presence in other countries as well, or are you just local to, I think, like the Pennsylvania market, Florida, and the East Coast? Do you have other clients in the U.S., or do you have other clients over the world or other offices as well, too?
We do. We don't really target any territory, per se. I would say when it comes to company or countries, rather, Canada and the U.S. are the main countries that we're operating in. But we have clients that also have offices in India and the Caribbean and other countries around the world. And we've actually gone out and done security assessments in India for some of our clients. But we're primarily, you know, cybersecurity solutions look the same no matter where you're at for the most part. So we can target pretty much anywhere. So we're very much a remote working type of situation where we have clients all over the U.S. I couldn't tell you which state most of our clients are in because it's just all over.
Right. Okay, cool. Excellent. Now, getting down to your customers and nuts and bolts of your business, who are you trying to target? Is it the SMBs, the federal government, Fortune 500? Perhaps a combination of all of them? Or really, what's your sweet spot that you really kind of like to go after?
Yeah, sweet spot, I would say, is medium enterprise and below. And one of our focuses whenever we first started Sequoia Cyber Solutions, even back in 2015, was the idea that large enterprises are, for the most part, taken care of. They have a lot of choices out there. There's a lot of consultant shops out there that cater to Fortune 1000, let's say. And we noticed a trend out there that medium enterprise and below weren't represented or had very good solutions available. You know, there was a clear line where the cybersecurity solutions that were available were looking at things like, we'll sell you 10,000 endpoint licenses, but there were very few solutions out there that I would say were cost-effective or right-sized for maybe a company with 25 employees or even 5 employees. So a lot of our customers are a mix between, I think our smallest one is there's one lady that has a health insurance company, and our largest one, off the top of my head, $1 billion publicly traded data center company that we've done physical penetration tests for. So we can really fit anything in between, but I would say our sweet spot is medium enterprise and below.
Okay, excellent. Now let's get into your product and service line. I was at your website last night, and the one thing that really impressed me, Sean, and I think you're about the only company I've really talked to so far in all the years in cyber, is that you actually help your clients take an offensive approach to cyber defenses too, not so much of a defensive, but an offensive as well too. And I'll be honest with you, I've worked with hundreds of cyber companies. This is the first I've heard of that term being used. So that's something that really caught my eye. And with that in mind, can you kind of do a deeper dive into your product and service lines, like the Delta, the Sentry, the Atlas, and the Compass, please?
Absolutely. So our offensive security, we call it, is our Delta. And the largest service that we offer in there is penetration testing. And that's where us as ethical hackers try to break into our customers' networks. And then we write up a report and say, this is how we got in. Sometimes they're physical assessments. So sometimes we're physically trying to break into buildings or bypass biometric controls or whatever the objective of the assessment might be. Our approach is that we try to find out what are the crown jewels. Each company is kind of a little bit different. If they're healthcare, it's going to be health information, things like that. If it's a financial company, it might be financial information, stock research, you know, whatever the company might be. And that's like one of the things I think that sets us apart from some of the other companies out there is the main tool that we use for our penetration testing is a human hacker, not a scanning tool or something like that. The scanning tool thing is kind of the next level down, where we call them vulnerability assessments. That's kind of our definition and terminology for those, where we'll run an automated scan. And then I think the value of us running that scan is we interpret the results and help to prioritize and put it in language that, as our customers have told us before, we could give our reports to someone non-technical, like maybe a CFO in a company, and they could understand the risk to their organization without it being too technical or over their head. So that's on the offensive side. Yeah, and because the way I see it is, because we're really good attackers, we make really good defenders as well. So I think the offensive and defensive security kind of go hand in hand. And I would say that's another thing that kind of sets us apart is we don't only focus on the offensive side or pen testing, or we don't only focus on the MSSP side or managed security service provider side, which is traditionally the defensive firewalls, email, secure email gateways, things like that. So that's what we call our Sentry side is the defensive side. Also secure network design, network segmentation, that all go into the defensive side. We're also a very big CrowdStrike shop. CrowdStrike is a endpoint detection and response, and we manage that for our clients. So manage detection and response. And that kind of has a foot in Sentry, our defensive side, because it's very, very good endpoint protection, in my opinion. And it's also a tool that we can use for incident handling and response. So it's also on what we consider our Atlas side. Our Atlas side is alerting and monitoring.
Excellent.
And then finally, the Compass side is the way we kind of see it is our Compass service provides guidance to companies that are looking to start a security program, but maybe they're not sure how to start one or where to start. So we kind of hang out on the back end as I like to think of us as like a cybersecurity department down the hall. So if you get a phishing email, if a question comes up that you're not sure, sometimes, a lot of times, cyber insurance companies will say, fill out this questionnaire in order to renew. That's something that we help out our clients with. Other times, there's vendors that ask for what they call third-party assessments, TPAs, where they'll ask things like, do you have endpoint security? Do you have multi-factor authentication? And a lot of times, you know, companies may receive those questionnaires and not be totally sure what they have or if something could be stood up easily. So they kind of look to us for that guidance to help out with that. And that's generally consumed as blocks of hours. So smaller companies, our smallest engagement that we have, bought 10 hours, and they just consume them as they consume them, and they just re-up the 10 hours every time we use the 10 hours. Other larger customers of ours might pay us for 5 hours a month or 10 hours a month. And we, again, hang out on the back end and help out with answering questions or sitting in meetings for secure network design, whatever. We're just basically a resource, just as if you had an in-house cybersecurity department.
Okay, excellent. Now, I'm at your website right now, too. I noticed that, do you do anything for the CMMC, like offering assessments or audits or anything like that to your clients?
We do, yeah. Another thing that I like to think of us as is we're the hands-on implementers and managers of cybersecurity solutions. So we're less about policy writing and auditing and having deep understanding of compliance. That's not really us. But what we can do is leverage a company that maybe they do an audit to see what controls they might be weak in. And sometimes those gap assessments are given to our clients. And this is true in the case of CMMC as well. Their terminology for something like that might be a POAM, they call it, where they kind of outline these are the controls, these are the deficiencies. And once that report's dropped on our client's doorstep, they might not have a clear vision on how to implement those solutions. So a 20-30 minute call with us, or, you know, we sign an NDA and you send over the gap assessments that you have, and we can propose solutions. And one of the principles that we try to apply is if there's 7 gaps, we try not to propose 7 solutions. We try to find the right size, cost-effective way. You know, maybe there's 2 solutions that cover all 7. We try to look for those opportunities. Because, again, we mainly focus on the medium enterprise and below, where budget is usually one of the top constraints.
Now, tell me, I've got a client out in Oregon. They're a huge, huge cloud services provider, and they do a lot of CMMC stuff for their clients. Is this still as screwed up as it is right now? I mean, it was always kind of a screwed up thing, but I think it's even more screwed up now. With the CMMC 2.0, what have you had any clients ask about that, or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's a big one to unpackage. In general, I would say it's a good thing in that it pushes companies that may not prioritize cybersecurity to have some level of cybersecurity. So I think that's a good thing. How it can be a bad thing is if they get check boxes, right? MFA, multi-factor authentication, do you have it? Yes or no? They don't ask what is the quality, where is it implemented. You know, it's kind of a loaded question, but if you just check the box, yes, we have it. Sometimes when those audits are completed, the company gets the report back. Hey, everything looks great. Everything's good with your audit, but there may be gaps there. So sometimes it requires kind of a deeper look, or we try to find solutions that not only check the box, but are actually effective. I know, as crazy as that sounds, there are solutions out there that can check a box, but they're not effective. And that could be just a weakness in the product or a misconfiguration or whatever the case may be. So we really, it might cost a little bit more. For example, CrowdStrike might cost a little bit more than like a Webroot or a Trend Micro or one of what they consider a legacy antivirus. But at the end of the day, that's going to prevent them from getting ransomware or something like that. In our opinion, CrowdStrike is one of the best out there for those scenarios.
Okay, excellent. Now, can you do a little bit of a deeper dive into the tech architecture that you use for your services? Are they like on-prem or on the cloud? And if it's in the cloud, what do you favor more, AWS or Azure?
Yeah, good question as well. It's my favorite answer to engineering questions is it depends. And in our case, we're very flexible. So we kind of meet you where you're at in your security journey where, you know, some companies, they already have a firewall, but they don't have money or they have a legacy antivirus and they're looking to replace it with something like CrowdStrike or something with a little deeper visibility and better protection and things like that. So it really just depends where they are in their program of what we would make recommendations for.
Okay. Have you used do you use more extensively, AWS or Azure? And what do you favor?
Yeah. So it's when it comes to security between the two, they're really green fields where it's as secure as you make them, you know, very similar to, and to answer your question a little deeper. Some of our clients still have on-prem or colo or data center presences, and some companies, some of our customers have hybrids where maybe they have on-prem equipment and a cloud environment, and some of our clients only have cloud environments. The thing about cybersecurity is, for the most part, a lot of the solutions can translate between those environments so they don't change form too much. There's definitely considerations. I mean, cloud security has its own concerns with how your policies and access management and things like that are set up under the hood. I don't necessarily have a preference between the two. It really depends on what the client objectives are. If a client has a deeper presence or licensing with Microsoft, then they might go with Azure. If a customer is already on AWS and that's where all their infrastructure is stood up, then it's really just about seeing where they're at in their journey, making sure that the security principles are applied not only on-prem or at their headquarters or remote offices, but also those same principles like multi-factor authentication and firewalling and access control is applied to the cloud environments as well.
Yeah. The reason I ask that is because I know Microsoft has really been proactive about offering, you know, making sure that, you know, your tools that use an M365 are CMMC compliant. In fact, I know they're doing a lot of work with the government, I think on, was it the GCC? I can't remember the acronym, the definition of that. And I think they're doing work with the FedRAMP High. They're doing a lot of good work.
Yep.
And so I think a lot of clients, SMBs that I know of, I think they favor Azure more. I'm a big fan of Azure. I have accounts both, but I think Azure is a little bit more user-friendly. That's just me. Anyway, but cool. Okay. Now, we were talking before the show, or perhaps even during the show, what separates you from the rest of the crowd? I mean, Sean, there are probably thousands and thousands of other people that kind of do the same thing you do, pen testing, you know, compliance, so forth. What separates you from the rest of the pack? Why should I come to you versus these up to 1,000 other vendors, for example?
Sure, yeah. That has a lot of different answers to it as well. And, of course, I'm going to be a little biased when I talk about us, but I honestly believe that we start first with having the right people and a great team. And I really enjoy coming to work every day, and I really feel like our team really enjoys coming to work every day and working with each other. Even though we're a remote company, we send, I don't know, hundreds of messages per day. We use Discord as a virtual office, and so we have channels for sales and engineering, and we have a water cooler where, you know, we post about drinking our cup of coffee in the morning or whatever it might be. And so we're very tightly knit, tied together between engineering and sales and everyone else that we have working with us. And our core values are high quality results, teamwork, and integrity. So it was very important when I was building Navisec that I've been an IT director before. I've been in IT leadership, and I really didn't like a lot of my IT vendors. I mean, the biggest complaint I would say is it felt like they were just trying to sell me something. Like there wasn't really some of the vendors I had, I did have strong relationships, and some of them were very good, but for the most part, it really felt like they would sell me anything just to make a dollar, and I didn't want to be one of those companies. So when we were building our sales team and things like that, integrity is huge. So I don't want to just tell you whatever you want to hear just to make a sale. I really want it to be effective. So we established that relationship, and our customers are our repeat customers. And most of them are, even in this space where a lot of times customers might say, hey, we go with a different pen testing firm every year. But if we can, I understand that, but if we can impress them and go out of our way, deliver a high quality result and put a face to what we deliver, then maybe there's opportunities to do other services. And then when the ball comes back around in 2 or 3 years, we can still continue to do that pen testing for them. So I really think it's just the team that we built sets us apart. Our focus on quality, we only sell like 3 or 4 certain vendors, and we're really good at those 3 or 4 vendors. So if you want to stand up a security program or you want to implement these solutions, then it really comes down to these are the vendors that we offer. We're not just going to take over whatever you have, because in our opinion, it doesn't match up to the couple of vendors that we do focus in on.
Okay, excellent. Now, on that note, do you have any customer success stories you can share with us, any client testimonials, obviously without revealing any confidential information?
Yeah, again, several. There's a healthcare company that we had a long track record with that when we had first started working with them, healthcare data that was basically sitting directly on the internet. And it was secured as best as it could be. But one of the major things we did is turn them around by getting them properly behind firewalls and performing their very first vulnerability assessments and performing their penetration testing and managing the security of their endpoints. And we really took them from almost the dark ages of having very little cybersecurity to being strong, but within a very short amount of time. And that company in particular, we've worked with them for years and years, and they, knock on wood, they'll continue to haven't had a single breach or major cybersecurity incident since we were able to implement that for them. So a lot of times in cybersecurity, the wins or the big achievements are something that doesn't happen, like a breach or a cyber attack or a compromise or something like that. So just in general, I think, again, knock on wood, the solutions that we pick and we implement and we know really well for our customers are ones that are just have a long proven track record of being very secure.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to share with us? Any other success stories or?
Yeah. So I guess we can kind of frame these as success, but it's an interesting discussion. Sometimes we talk to clients and, I get it. I've been in IT leadership before, and sometimes it's not always my call in IT leadership either, but we talk to a vendor or we find a solution that we feel like we really need to have, but maybe we don't have the budget or there's some other reason why we can't implement it today and maybe next quarter or maybe the beginning of next year, something like that. And we talk to those clients and we always close the calls out saying, hey, just, hang on to our number. If things change, let us know. And sometimes those turn into what we call 911 calls. And it's always 5:30 on a Friday or, I better knock on wood again, Easter Sunday, we've gotten calls. Because the attackers know that people aren't looking maybe as closely to alerting and things like that. So they may be targeting these companies in our off hours. And like clockwork, it almost seems like 5:30 on a Friday is when they all hit. But there's a lot of different examples. Like the Log4j that just happened is one that's been in the news. Hafnium was the exchange hacks a year ago this month. The Hafnium exchange attacks all came out. And we had four different companies call us within 2 or 3 weeks that we had talked to them. We made an impression, but they weren't able to move forward with whatever the solution might have been that we talked to them about. And they called up and said, you know, hey, we just noticed that we had a breach. And so we come in after something happened and try to determine how much data might have been taken, what's the extent of the breach. And a lot of times that turns into consulting on network segmentation, or if you have VPNs going to all your locations, are those firewalled and have good access control? So if an attacker did get into the Exchange server, can they jump to your other offices? That usually turns into a bigger design discussion. But I kind of consider that a success story because, you know, we have a client that might call us up in the middle of an emergency and they don't know the extent, or, you know, they don't know if they're going to be in business tomorrow, depending on the compromise or the breach or whatever happened. So being able to get them from the sky's falling, I don't know what's going on, to some peace of mind and getting security solutions in place. I always say we never like to engage with our clients that way, but I'm glad to be a resource that they think of to call when something bad does happen.
Okay, excellent. Now, for your customers, do you offer like any free trials or any free assessments before you onboard them as a customer, or how do you do that?
We do, and we can. There's CrowdStrike. We can, you know, depending on the situation, offer. They call them proof of value, right? When I was in IT leadership, they were proof of concepts. But yeah, there's a limited week or two trial where we can drop it into environments. Usually the worst detections we see with CrowdStrike are when we're first rolling it out and we're displacing something like Sophos or WebRoot or something like that. That doesn't always catch the threats that are out there just because of the way that it behaves versus how CrowdStrike behaves. And so sometimes even in the proof of values that we do, it's catching things that might have been living on the system for months that Sophos or some other solution didn't catch. So that's always a good entry point as a kind of a demo or a free test. We can also do, so Fortinet has a program. They've had it for as long as I've been working with them, so 2014, 2013. They call it the CTAP program, which is a cyber threat assessment program where they'll put a FortiGate firewall in front of your existing firewall, and it'll run reports. You can actually put it behind as well. So it'll tell you if you have an existing firewall, what threats might have been missed. And it's a good snapshot where they can put it in line. It generates a report after a week or two, and it gives you an idea of what attacks are actually coming into a potential client's network. And then we always get back on a call after that, go over the report, and just have a snapshot of, is what you have today, is it as strong as a FortiGate? That's one strategy that we might use there.
Okay, excellent. Now, back to your company, do you have any plans for expansion? Do you just plan to keep doing what you're doing, grow that way, or do you plan to, I guess, as I alluded to, maybe do some more, open up some virtual offices overseas? What are your plans?
Yeah, we definitely have plans to grow, and we've grown 2x year over year since we rebranded in 2019, and that doesn't look like it's slowing down. We've got some other plans up our sleeve for maybe there's things that we can tweak and adjust and make stronger that maybe we can do more than 2x. So I'm trying to do it in a way that grows intelligently. And so, you know, we're past the survival stage. Those days were pretty rough early on, but even now I'm scrutinizing every dollar to make sure that it's the right choice or the right thing to expand into. And I think we've been pretty successful growing that way. I don't want to grow too quickly or grow too slowly. I mean, you're trying to hit that sweet spot in the middle. So I think we can expect to grow 2x this year, but I've got some things I'm applying now that hopefully we can even 2.5 or 3x this year.
Excellent. Now, as we come into the last part of the show here, I just kind of want to talk about some other issues in the cyber threat landscape. You know, 2 years ago, it was COVID, and we'll touch base on that. And then just recently announced the Russian invasion into Ukraine. I guess nobody thought it would happen, but it did happen. And so now things like critical infrastructure, worries about that, that's all coming into the forefront now. But the first one I want to talk to you about is artificial intelligence. I wrote a huge book on that, and to me, AI is nothing but garbage in, garbage out on a technical level. But the cyber industry seems to take that term and really beat it to death, and you'll see a lot of vendors that I'll say that to their customer. And the customer, oh, I got AI in my system, it's like, big deal, And in fact, a vendor may not even put an AI thing. He's kind of like, I guess, lying about it, but you know what I'm talking about, right? But anyway,
I wouldn't fully disagree with you.
AI. So what are your thoughts on AI? Do you use it for any of your tools, like for pen testing? For automating, this mundane text. Well, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, there's some of our products that do leverage machine learning. CrowdStrike is one of them. And how it leverages machine learning is, so I guess one definition I should talk about. I'm saying legacy antivirus, and CrowdStrike is considered a next generation antivirus. And the major difference between the two, when I say legacy, I mean like Sophos or WebRoot, things like that. An antivirus 10 years ago basically has a giant dictionary of file hashes or, an its own personal encyclopedia of which files look like viruses, basically what it is. Mm-hmm. And if that file signature matches with a signature in the database, then it's bad. Block it, quarantine it, and everything's good. And that doesn't always work. And I'm a certified pen tester, and I went through offensive securities program. That's actually the name of a certification company. And they teach you right in some of the beginning pages how to evade antivirus programs like that. So those solutions aren't as effective as they were if they ever were. I guess that's unfair. They were effective, better than nothing. But the next generation antivirus, how it works is it's looking at the behavior of processes in your machine. And the way the story kind of I like to tell that explains that is if there's a human watching a process on the computer and that process indexes files on a hard drive and then it loads encryption keys into memory and then it deletes volume shadow copy or backups of the files and then it encrypts those files. At some point in that chain of events, a human would say, hey, this doesn't look right. Let's kill the process and quarantine it. And that's what CrowdStrike is doing. Is looking at the behavior of those processes, and under the hood, it says it's applying machine learning in those decisions as well, because it's not always that straightforward to determine if a process is malicious or not. So that's one way that machine learning kind of intersects with us. Fortinet has a couple of products that also leverage machine learning. The one I'm most interested in that maybe have some effectiveness today is their web application firewall called FortiWeb, and I've demoed and labbed it out a couple times, and it learns, on paper, it says it learns what normal web requests are, and then it marks which web requests are anomalies, which does make a lot of sense, because let's say as a pen tester or ethical hacker, when I'm trying to break into a web application, I'm trying to send that web application web requests that maybe that application can't generate on its own through the UI, through the user interface. And so that might be the first time that a FortiWeb sees that kind of request, because it's only generated through a hacking tool, let's say. So that might mark it as an outlier and block it just based on it not being something that it's seen before. It's an outlier. So that technology in particular, I think there's some value there.
Okay, cool. Awesome. Sounds great. Now, another topic, Sean, that's kind of I feel a little quirky about is this thing called the Internet of Things. Okay. I'm an old-fashioned kind of guy, and I'll be honest with you, and I think I may have told you in one of our meetings, I hate technology to the core. As much as I love writing about it, I hate it. And in fact, on my iPhone, I don't have any mobile apps except for my Yahoo email. The Internet, I drive an old Honda Civic in 03, all analog instrumentation, 17 years old, and knock on wood, still running fine. the Internet of Things is a kind of scary thing to me, you know, and it's where everything's all connected, you know, but that's increases the attack surface for the cyber attacker. And now we got this thing coming up called the metaverse, where everything is represented by avatars and this and that. It's like, what's this world coming to? Have we lost our normal physical identity? What's going on? And so what are your thoughts on that? I mean, do you have like a smart car and do you have like a smart home and smart gadgets and you clap your hands and your coffee maker starts that kind of thing? Or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, there's always that sliding scale between convenience and accessibility and security. And definitely if something is bleeding edge or in its early days, then there's the potential for it to have a lot of vulnerabilities where someone in Argentina could turn your lights on and off. I mean, that's it's definitely a possibility in the Internet of Things days.
Now, that's very, very scary.
It is. And the people that are building those devices, you know, there's definitely I'll just say there's a lot of like public libraries and GitHubs and things like that that are available out there that a lot of these devices, they may not be writing everything from scratch. They may be including other libraries that are out there. And so if there's a vulnerability in a library that's used by 100,000 devices worldwide, then typically, I mean, it's much harder to do patch management and keep track of firmware and things like that on a light bulb. For example, especially, you know, some of these larger companies, they might have 1,000, 10,000, you know, who knows how many of these smart devices all over their environment and maybe no good infrastructure or processes to make sure that the firmware for all those things are kept.
Excellent. Now, the next thing is 2 years ago, Sean, was this thing called COVID, okay, when it came out in December, was it 2019? I guess we all thought it would just stay in China, it wouldn't spread, but COVID has really turned the world upside down in ways that were never imagined, you know, both obviously for the bad and for the good. So the good, you know, we got vaccines quicker to market. And the other thing is the remote workforce, which I already thought would happen for 5 years from now. Well, it's actually happened. Now it's going to be here permanently for the most part. How has that impacted you? How has it impacted your clients? What are your thoughts about this whole thing? Are you in favor of a complete 100% remote workforce? Do you like a hybrid? Or just what are your thoughts on that in general? It doesn't have to be security. I mean, just in general, like how has it touched your life personally?
Well, one of the bigger things when it comes to the remote workforce and things like that is you're taking what was traditionally a safe environment in a company office that had firewalls and web filters and all these security controls on it, and now you're expecting your employees to use those devices or laptops or company phones or whatever and put them on their home network, which may have, you know, kids on it and may have people that are non-technical, and you don't have the corporate cybersecurity solutions available. You know, you might not have a $50,000 firewall connected to your internet connection at home. So it's typically a pretty hostile environment. So one of the things that in particular, just as one example, how do you secure an environment like that? You really don't. The best thing you can do is secure the business asset. That's where CrowdStrike really turned into a tool that was really useful for this work from home thing, because we can install CrowdStrike and it calls back into a dashboard in AWS. So it can be controlled and monitored, and you get visibility into the processes that are running on those company assets, even if they're in hostile environments. And it also gives you some tools to network contain the device, which could traditionally, you know, be a firewall function. You know, you block the MAC address or the IP address or whatever to prevent that machine from going out if it's in a scenario where maybe there's an attacker that's currently connected to that machine, where in CrowdStrike you can click a button, disconnect it, so only the CrowdStrike dashboard can interact with that machine. That's one of the advantages. Another advantage in CrowdStrike in particular is what they call real-time response. So if we need to connect to a machine and get a sample of malware, or we're not sure, maybe there's a temp file that looks suspicious, we can get a copy of that file and try to reverse engineer it or try to figure out what's going on with that file while still not being intrusive on an employee's personal devices, right? So privacy is very important there, where we're really only protecting just that business asset in a home personal environment.
Okay. Now, another question here that's tangential to this one is, there are a lot of clients, I've had a few, and some of my other clients have had their own clients, like this big cloud shop I was telling you about. Some of their clients made a big move into Azure, to kind of get away from the traditional on-prem, because they said, enough, we're not going to pay $2,000 a month rent. We want everything online. We're going to work from home. Have you had a lot of clients that kind of just decide to say screw to their on-prem and just go on the cloud as they make that transition to the remote workforce?
I don't know if the remote workforce or us working from home has changed that much. I would say one of the first challenges that we were trying to solve with the remote workforce was employees that were quarantined or mandates where people had to stay home or whatever, but you also still had a file server in your office, or you had office assets that or information that you needed access to in order for those employees to do their jobs. So one of the first things that we started seeing was, hey, can you help me set up a VPN into the office, where typically maybe only the IT staff had that access so they could log in from home and fix a network problem. But now you have the remote workforce that needs to VPN into the office in order to do their jobs, to access the same resources that they would have accessed when they were sitting in that office, if that makes sense.
Yeah, excellent. Okay. Now, another one I think you kind of alluded to earlier in our conversation was about cybersecurity insurance. Now, do you guys actually, I don't think you're brokers, but if you are you like insurance brokers? Do you help them select a plan, or do you just kind of help your clients fill in paperwork? Do you make recommendations? How do you work with that when clients ask that kind of question? Because honestly, cybersecurity insurance is just about, is this as worse than medical insurance, trying to figure out what's going on? Because a lot of SMB owners, in my opinion, they think, they think they've got this blanket policy protection. Now they don't have to worry about cyber, right? They think they're going to get, their money in case they get breached. But, the insurance companies are going to, they're going to want to make sure that they have the controls in place. They're not going to get a payout. And in fact, what's that one insurance company, somewhere in France, I can't remember, AXA, I think, they stopped giving out payouts if you do make a ransomware payment. So how do you help your clients there?
Yeah, so we're not brokers, and we don't necessarily want to be. We're very good at cybersecurity, and that's what we want to do. And that goes back to our core values of high-quality results. We're not just going to do everything because we can make money on it potentially. But where we do intersect with cyber insurance is a lot of times our clients reach out to us sometimes in a daze, right? Like, hey, our cybersecurity insurance company said that they're not going to renew us unless we have two-factor authentication and endpoint detection and response. What do we do? And the biggest challenge there is usually monetary. They contact us and all of a sudden, hey, in 30 days, I need to stand up endpoint detection and response. And that might not be a low-cost item if you have 1,000 endpoints, for example. That's typically how we intersect with the cyber insurance. I definitely have seen before where people make statements like, why would I care about cybersecurity if I have cybersecurity insurance? It'll pay me out. It'll bail me out. But there's all these other effects, like their reputation, right? So, when there is a big compromise, the first thing that happens in the media is they're scrutinized. Well, how strong is their security? How did this happen? And you may get a payout, but what about the potential loss of customers? Because I wouldn't want to go to a healthcare company that, we have very little controls, but we have all this cyber insurance that'll help pay if something goes wrong. I wouldn't want my family's medical records at a place like that.
Yeah, actually, it's funny because I was a contractor for Blue Cross Blue Shield a long time ago, a few years ago. I was doing like tech writing in their security division, and they got breached with a cyber attack, and it was like, okay. Anyway, it was kind of interesting at the time. But anyway, finally, the data privacy laws. Apart from the CMMC, as we've talked about, there's a CCPA and a GDPR. Have you guys been affected by that, or any of your other clients been? Have your clients faced any audits to help them do the risk assessment in that regard?
It does come up from time to time, generally with the GDPR. If our clients have a European presence, then they may have certain requirements. Generally, the requirements I'm most familiar with are usually around privacy. So the ability to remove data or identify where data is stored, things like that. Yeah, but otherwise, it's very similar to like what I mentioned before with if there's a gap assessment done and there's solutions that need to be put in place, we help to identify and implement those solutions.
Okay. Excellent. So now, as we start to wrap up our show, Sean, what do you think the cyber threat landscape is going to look like this year? Obviously, the Russian-Ukrainian situation has really changed things into another direction, just like COVID did. What do you think is going to happen this year?
Well, if the past is any indicator, and it tends to keep replaying, I think the biggest threats that are out there are to prolific software that everyone uses and vulnerabilities being discovered and quickly exploited by automated scripts and threat actors out there, similar to what we saw with Hafnium. The news, we see these types of things are happening more and more. So how do you protect yourself against the Log4j or Hafnium or whatever the threats are that are out there? And in my opinion, it starts with the basics, right? Making sure you have good endpoint detection and response, making sure you have firewalls in place, making sure you're doing regular vulnerability assessments and pen testing and web application pen testing.
Okay, excellent. Now, finally, Sean, as we come to the end of our show here, what is the best way for someone to contact you in case they want to reach out to you? Suppose they're having a security breach or they just want to talk to you more about your services. What's the best way for them to contact you?
So our website has all our contact information. It's navisec.io, NAVISEC.io. Or you know, if you want to reach out to me directly, I can be found pretty easy on LinkedIn, or my email address is just firstname.lastname@navisec.io, Sean, S-E-A-N dot Nobles, N-O-B-L-E-S.
Okay. Well, Sean, thank you very much for your time this morning, and we appreciate it. You shed a lot of insights into cybersecurity, and we look forward to having you again in the future, okay?
Happy to help. Thank you, Ravi.
Thank you. Take care. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.